Okay, well, look, everybody, yeah, so good to spend some time with you and to catch up with you again. And I can't see all of you, but I can see many of your names here in the little list. So you're welcome. And I just really hope that you're all going okay and coping with the you know, astonishing situation. I'm not going to talk too much about the pandemic and all of these things. I'm sure that you're probably like me, overwhelmed with the news and information and everything like that. So I'm not going to talk too much about the details, but you know that stay safe, follow the guidelines, don't be stupid, and look after each other, because in a time like this, the ones that will really suffer are the ones who already had, you know, were already on the edge or already were marginal. The poor, the disadvantaged, the homeless, the refugees, the marginalized, the discriminated, then people like that are always going to be the ones who suffer. So make sure that you look out for people and try to help where you can. So the title of the talk here was inspired by a note that somebody made that we, you know, here we are all trapped in our rooms, trapped in our homes, and sort of locked down, much like the Princess Rapunzel was in her fairy tale. And somebody pointed out that in the Disney version of that story, Rapunzel was the hero who came to save Rapunzel, the handsome prince who came to save Rapunzel, came from the kingdom of Corona. And this seems like a strange coincidence. I don't necessarily read anything into it, but as Carl Jung pointed out, that coincidences can be meaningful. So one of the themes and one of the things that I've been trying to talk about in, you know, quite a number of years now is the role of storytelling and narrative in understanding our situation, understanding our humanity, understanding who we are and what we're doing. In Buddhism, as a Buddhist monk, you see, my profession is to be alone. And in the suttas, it constantly says, ego, vupakato, appamato, alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent. And, you know, the formula for the first jhana begins by saying, viviceva kamehi, quite secluded from sensual pleasures. And we love to be alone. And I'm sure I will, probably agree with me there that for monastics, the chance of spending some time alone and not traveling and so on is great. And of course, the monastic life both attracts people who have that tendency, but also it gives you an environment and a context where you can find meaning in that life of solitude and stillness. Now, traditionally, a monastic life, yes, might have been a life of solitude, but also was a life that was said to be wide open. And we, the lucky few who have had the blessing to take up the yellow robe and to live this life, we are not weighed down with the burdens of possessions and property and houses and all of those things, and we have relatively the ability to travel from one place to another fairly lightly. Of course, there are many complexities to this, and especially these days. Now we have visas and we have health insurance and we have all of those kinds of things to consider. Obviously, it's also a lot easier for monks to travel than it is for nuns. There's a lot more places to go to. But still, there is that kind of idea which is at the heart of the monastic life, which is that we have a certain sense of freedom from being weighed down too heavily by a sense of place and a sense of responsibility to a physical, particular physical environment. So we have those two sides. One side is that we enjoy the solitude and that stillness, but we also enjoy that freedom of being able to wander. So here, now that we're all in lockdown, in a sense, we're all basically like Rapunzel, and Rapunzel being trapped in her tower. Now, the story of Rapunzel is one of a variety of stories that are frequently told in fairy tales, and we find in the Indian tradition just as in the Western tradition. And I wrote a book a number of years ago called Dreams of Bhadda, which talks about a similar story, a story that had a similar motif in it, with a young woman known as Bhadda, who later on went on to become one of the famous nuns. Now, in terms of, you know, sociology and ethnographic terms, that motif of the young girl or the young woman who's trapped in a tower, trapped in a room, kept in solitude, reflects the historical and the cultural practice of isolating girls as they had their first menstruation and as they became women, and they became locked up as being tabooed. Sometimes they were locked up because, well, you didn't want them gadabouting around the place with their newfound desires and womanhood and whatever, and who knows what could happen. So this is kind of idea that that womanhood was dangerous and was something that needed to be managed and controlled. Now that's a cultural practice, and it's still a reality in the world for many women. I'm not going to talk too much about the anthropology of it, but in terms of a lived experience, then it's a lived experience. It's a way of telling stories that reflects a certain kind of lived experience, and in storytelling, the stories that are told of women are typically the stories that are told in a domestic setting. And so again, this is not saying that this is right or wrong. It's not saying this is how it should be. It's just reflecting that this is the kinds of stories that have been passed down to us. Beauty and the Beast or Bluebeard and so on. And these are all kind of stories where woman is in the home and has to face up in some way to the challenges that's found there. So now if we take that story kind of literally, I mean, where we are now in Harris Park in Sydney, you know, here we are two monks who are staying here in a little flat, and you know, we're quite comfortable, we get fed, and you know, we have our meditation and we have community and we have things to do. So we're basically getting on fine. In the apartments that we're staying in, everyone in our area is Indian and everybody's working class. Very often they have, you know, these are smallish two bedroom flats, and very often, you know, there might be 8 or 10 people staying in one of the flats, and sometimes with kids as well. So the kids are going a bit stir crazy and running around. And you can imagine that Rapunzel or some of the other young women who were trapped in those kinds of environments would have been quite reluctant participants in that kind of thing. Just as today, if you try to tell a teenager not to go out and not to have fun, then it can be a difficult task. So in a way, we're lucky because we have that training and we have that sense of practice and meaning that can give us something to do when we're isolated. No? Unlike Rapunzel, for her, it's just an imprisonment. For us as Dhamma practitioners, as meditators, we have an opportunity and we can make use of that opportunity. I just met one of the young Sri Lankan man from the community, and he said one of his flatmates had the virus, and they'd had been on quarantine for 14 days. So he took the chance to do a retreat. And so he downloaded all the talks from one of the retreats at the Buddhist Society and did the retreat for 2 weeks. So that was the way that he coped. So we're very lucky. So take this opportunity. Don't give it up. The path of nature has a path of growth and has a path of stasis. And it has a cycle. And it has a cycle of growth in the summer and stillness in the winter. And you remember winters, right? In Europe? That's the thing that you used to have in your parents' day or your grandparents' day. When there was snow on the ground and so on. Yeah, you've seen the postcards. And in winter, things stop. Or at least they slow down. And in mythology and in fairy tales, that idea of the cycle of things is always very prominent. As indeed it is in Buddhism and in the Dhamma. The Buddha didn't believe in a sort of singular and linear history. He always spoke in terms of cycles. And if we understand time in terms of cycles, then we have a very different perspective on things. If we take things from the modern idea of progress, then, for example, economic growth is a good thing. And as long as the economy is growing, we're happy. And people are making money and people are employed and there's always new things and more things and faster things and better things. That's great if what you're concerned about is the economy. But nature doesn't work like that. Nature works in waves and in cycles, in periods of growth and in periods of stasis and quiet. And of course, anybody, if you know even a little bit about economics, you know that in fact, economics does the same thing. Any economy has a period of growth and a period of decline. And they call like depressions and recessions and so on. And it's a natural cycle or an unnatural cycle, I guess, in the case of economies. And yet somehow, because we are conditioned to accept the ideology of progress, we see recession and economic downturn as something bad, rather than accepting it as actually part of nature, a part of an opportunity for us to do things we wouldn't have done otherwise. And some of our friends have said that, one of our friends said that they had recently had a baby girl. And the father was being forced to work at home. And he said if he hadn't had to work at home, then he wouldn't have been able to spend so much time with his young daughter. And he'd been able to be with her, you know, so much time, just as she's newly born. And just imagine that in terms of the psychological imprint that caring and that nurturing from the father makes on that young girl when she's growing up. That's a huge difference in somebody's life. And this is the kind of possibility that a period of quiet can have. Our problem isn't that there are downturns. Our problem isn't that there are periods of quiet when people don't work. We look at unemployment figures and think, oh, that's terrible. People are out of work. But if you look at traditional societies, people in traditional societies always spend a considerable portion of the year out of work. If you go to any village where they're growing rice, there's a time of sowing, a time of reaping, a time of harvesting, and then there's a time for just sitting around and kicking back. And there's not really much to be done. The rice is growing in the fields, and you just pretty much wait. And this is normal. This is how life is. There's nothing natural about a life that's constantly driven to do more and more and more, and to have more and more, and to be more and more. It's natural to have these cycles. So our problem isn't that these cycles are there. Our problem is that we don't cater for them. We don't build our expectations for them. And so when they come, we're surprised and we don't have the resources that we need. We haven't stocked up in times of plenty. We haven't taken care of those who are in need. We haven't provided shelter for the homeless. We haven't provided food for those who are hungry. We haven't provided medicines for those who are sick. We assume that things will keep on going more and more and more, better and better, so we don't have to do those things. And that's why we panic, and that's why when the downturn does happen, there's so much pain and so much suffering. Instead of squandering our wealth on, gewgaws and useless rubbish, we should be using the wealth that we're making for something which is more meaningful, looking after each other, taking care of each other. And if we were to do that, then these kinds of things wouldn't be so bad, and we'd have at least some ability to cope. So our problem is not that there's an economic downturn or that there's a slowdown in the economy, that there's a slowdown in the rate of the financial prosperity. Our problem is that we have built our expectations and our ideologies on the fruitless and impossible dream of eternal growth. There was a sort of semi-tongue-in-cheek study done a number of months ago about the topic of eternal growth, and the person who did that essentially extrapolated from the recent economic growth on planet Earth in the last century or so and said, what happens if we continue to grow at that same rate? And our energy consumption continues to grow at the same rate, and he calculated that within a couple of thousand years, which is nothing in galactic life cycles, within a couple of thousand years, to run the economy would require the combined output of every sun in the galaxy. That's how much. That's how to run an economy if we're going to have eternal growth. In other words, it's impossible. It's physically impossible to have an economy based on eternal growth. And the only reason that we've done it these last, few decades, couple of hundred years, the period that we're used to of constant economic growth is entirely a historical anomaly, and especially such rapid economic growth. Sure, there's been periods of economic growth and prosperity in the past, but to have this massive rapid economic growth across so much of the world is fueled by industrialization, fueled by fossil fuels, and it's unsustainable. And it won't work. It's breaking down nature, it's breaking down the environmental order, and it will all come crashing down. And so meanwhile, here we are in our little rooms, like our little Rapunzel, and we sit on the floor or sit in a chair, and we close our eyes and we try to meditate. And when we meditate, none of those things are real. The economy isn't real. The future isn't real. The story of Rapunzel isn't real. Heck, even you aren't real. There's just your breath, or just your metta, or just whatever it is that you're focusing on in your meditation. And so we have an ability, we have a capacity to find a place where we will be free of these burdens and these worries. This is part of our spiritual development. And that gives us a certain resilience and a certain capacity to cope when things don't go well. And it gives us more than that. It also gives us a certain space, because so long as we are caught up when these huge changes happen, so long as we're caught up in these huge changes, we just react to them. And you can see this is what is going on in the world today. You know, there's a few people who are saying things can't go back to normal. We have to change the way we do things and so on. Obviously, they're right. But what are the chances that that will actually happen? I'm not particularly optimistic. What I believe will mostly happen is that we'll come out of the other side of this, and the overriding narrative will be, how do we get back to normal? How do we get economic growth back on target? How do we get employment back on target? And so on and so forth. Because that's all that people know. And in these times, most people are not challenging their views and their ideas and their values, but they're doubling down on them. And they're seeing their own beliefs being reinforced by whatever's happening. And I'm sure you're all familiar with all of the different conspiracy theories and sort of delusional nonsense that's being pumped around the world. The latest piece of advice from the clown in chief was to that we should all be drinking disinfectant to get rid of the virus. Do not do that. And as a general rule, don't listen to anything that you from, you know, conspiracy theories and social media and all of these kind of people who think they know the answer and they think they've got the truth. If you want information about the virus, listen to the actual medical authorities, the people who are studying this and the people who are spending their lifetimes trying to, you know, trying to understand and work out how these things work. So here we are. We have this opportunity. As individuals, we have this opportunity to spend time and to spend space. But don't think of it as just as an opportunity to do some meditation. Think of it as an opportunity to question all of your values and priorities. In the story of Rapunzel, in the story of how she's trapped in that cell, in that room, that story is not just a story of injustice. Okay? Obviously, on a social level and an anthropological level, we shouldn't be locking girls up in rooms, obviously, huh? But at the same time, that's the place where she grew. That's her home in many ways. And the same thing with something like, say, Beauty and the Beast. When she goes to the home with the beast, obviously this is a metaphor for domestic violence and for the threat that women face in the home. And that particular story, Beauty and the Beast, shows her triumphing and her winning over the beastly nature of the man. Other stories, and she fails, as happens in real life as well. So these things reflect sociological conditions, and those sociological conditions are very much still present today and very much a part of this pandemic, as we're all locked up in our tower, like Rapunzel, or like Beauty, or like the heroines of these fairy tales, then especially the women, are vulnerable and are subject to abuse and to domestic violence in quite a terrifying ways, as well as the children, I might add. So this is something I think that's important to look out for, and it's important to remember for all of us in our communities. Look out for your own family, your brothers and sisters, people that you know. Look out for your neighbors. Look out for people around you, people in your community, and just be aware of the signs of these things. Because believe it or not, these things happen in families just like yours. They happen in neighborhoods just like yours. They happen in spiritual communities, in Dhamma communities just like yours. So don't be somebody who stays blind to these things or who ignores the warning signs when they happen. If somebody says that there's a problem going on, then listen to them and take them seriously and make sure to do something about it. So as we are in our period of quiet and our period of solitude, we have that ability to reflect. And just as a society as a whole has an ability to reflect, and we as individuals have an ability to reflect. And we have an ability to question our values. In the classical myth of the hero, the hero will go out from the home and go into a wilderness where the boundaries and the norms of society are relaxed, and that wilderness might be a desert, it might be a jungle, it might be an ocean, it might be a, you know, interstellar space. But it's somewhere where all of the rules and all of the conventions, all of the expectations are left behind, at least for a period of time, they're suspended. And that's where you can find who you are, because you're not judging yourself in terms of what others are expecting you to be. And for this time in isolation, that's also a similar time that we get to go through, because we get to be ourselves and we don't have to be the person who's showing up to work or the person who's doing that or the person who's doing the other. To some degree, we get to suspend who we are or at least to suspend who we have been, who we think we are. And I'm aware, of course, this is very different for different people. It depends very largely on context. If you've got to look after a family, or if you're still working at your job or something like that, then of course it's very different. But I think for many people, or at least for some people, then there's relatively a chance to reflect. And given that chance, I think we shouldn't just say, okay, I'm just going to do some meditation. I'm not saying you shouldn't do some meditation. I'm just saying you shouldn't just do some meditation, because too often just doing some meditation becomes, I'm going to do this technique in order to get that result, which I already think that I know what it is and I want to get. You see the problem here? You're already defining what the outcome is by the technique that you've done. And what technique is it that you're doing? Well, the technique somebody told you to do, something you learned from an app, something some teacher said, something you read in a book. How do you know that that technique is right for you? How do you know that that's the meditation that you should be doing? You only know that from your own reflection. To look into yourself and ask yourself, look, after all these years of meditation, am I becoming a better person? Am I kinder? Am I more mindful? Am I more peaceful? Am I wiser? And start to ask yourself, like, what are the kinds of values that are coming to the fore, that are emerging within me through this process of meditation? And don't be too ideological and too dogmatic about this. It's not meditation, like Buddhist meditation and Buddhist practice, it's not about sort of putting meditators through a meat grinder and ending up with meditator sausage, okay? You don't, I'm sorry, that's a horrible image, but my apologies. And you end up, everyone's just the same, right? This is what it feels to me sometimes. I've got a meditation factories and they just kind of snap meditators out. Yes, you're all the same because you're all in these things. That's not how spiritual development works. It's not how spiritual growth works. You go into nature and you look in the forest at how the trees grow. Do all the trees grow the same way? Of course not. Some of them grow in rocky places, some in sandy places, some grow on the plains, some on the side of the hills. They all grow in different places and they thrive in their own way, depending on causes and conditions. That's how nature works. So for genuine spiritual growth, it's up to us to be able to reflect inside ourselves and to see what happens when we relax these conventions of who we are, who we're expected to be, who society wants us to be, who our family wants us to be, who some spiritual teacher wants us to be, what the suttas say we should want to be, and of course in the back of our minds the little voices of our mummy and daddy who are still telling us what they expect us to be and who we're still trying to live up to and still trying to impress all these years later. And that, I'm not saying that we should ignore all those voices. These are the voices of wisdom. It's how we learn. But none of them is the voice that's going to give you the answer that you're going to need. And the answer to what values that you have and how you want to live your life, that answer is going to come to you when your mind is quiet. And that answer is going to arise to you and present itself to you in a way that is shining and immaculate and unimpeachable. It will become, when you see what is your reality and what is your truth and what is your path, then everything's so obvious. It's so clear. Oh, this is what I should be doing. And this is something like for myself, you know, I've been doing this for a long time, but I still go through periods where, you know, when I come to doubts and unclarity about what I should be doing, then I take myself out of my normal environment and just see what happens. And, you know, for example, a number of years ago when I left, I mentioned that I was formerly the abbot of Santi, and when I left Santi, I didn't know what to do. And as a monk, especially as a senior monk, sometimes it can be a bit difficult to escape people's scrutinies and expectations. So I ended up catching a train down to Sydney, got off the train with just my bowl and my bag, and just walked down the street. Didn't know where I was going, had no plans and no expectations. And so I just slept in the parks outside for a few days, went for bindabata in the local markets and local streets with my bowl, and wandered around the place. And I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. I had like literally zero conception of what I was going to be doing apart from just this moment in this place, sitting in a park, sitting under a tree, walking down a road. And so I spent a few days like that. So don't be afraid to suspend and to question your values. Questioning your values doesn't mean getting rid of the things that are important to you, and it doesn't mean getting rid of the wisdom that you've had. It means that from time to time in our lives that we should question these things and we should reevaluate them. And the things in our lives which are really valuable, the wisdom and the compassion and the things that really matter to us, they will stay with us and they'll come back. But we'll be also be able to see what are those things that don't really matter to us and things that we can leave behind. So this is just a short talk for you today on how to, I guess, make the most of your time in lockdown, and to give you some encouragement to pursue your spiritual practice, to don't be afraid of the changes and the questions in your values that come through this practice and through this time, and also some reflection, I guess, about I think that we should have some courage to begin to imagine what kinds of changes we'll expect to see in the world around us when things come back to normal, I guess.